This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us for the Ed Johnson Conversations, Part 2. In 1906, Ed Johnson, a young black man, was falsely accused and wrongfully convicted of a crime he did not commit here in Chattanooga, the assault and rape of Nevada Taylor, a young white woman. Johnson's case reached the United States Supreme Court, which issued a stay of execution, but a violent mob took the law into its own hands and lynched him on the Walnut Street Bridge. From his arrest, through his trial, to the final moments of his life, Ed Johnson said again and again, "I am an innocent man." We are bringing you a series of conversations with members of the Ed Johnson Project about his story from more than a century ago and the memorial in this century at the south end of the bridge where his life ended. This hour, we hear from two longtime Chattanoogans, Catherine McCauley Gardner and Ardina Garth Hicks. As you will hear, Catherine's family played a role in the Ed Johnson story. Ardina is an attorney and a former Hamilton County public defender. This conversation follows Ed Johnson's case in February and March of 1906 through the appeal of his conviction and death sentence, a legal journey that leads to Knoxville and all the way to Washington, D.C. Ardina, Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having us.
We want to talk about the appeal process in the Ed Johnson case. There was a question in the beginning about whether an effort to appeal would even be made.
Well, there definitely was a question. And in fact, the decision had been made that there would not be an appeal. There were three white appointed attorneys representing Ed Johnson. They decided that if they filed an appeal, Ed Johnson was going to be lynched. And therefore, they advised him not to appeal, because his choice, as attorney W.G.M. Thomas said to him, your choice is to be put to death in an orderly manner if you don't appeal, or lynched, beaten and lynched by a mob if you do appeal. That, to me, is just a flabbergasting basis to decide whether or not you're going to launch an appeal.
And especially for an event that happened less than 3 months prior. I mean, we're talking about a really, you know, really quick turnaround.
But an appeal was made, and that process began, it is said, with a conversation between Ed Johnson's father and Noah Pardon, the leading African-American attorney in Chattanooga.
The trial began on February 6th. It ended on February 8th. The afternoon of February 8th, Skinbone Johnson, who was Ed Johnson's father, went to Noah Pardon to ask him to take the appeal. The story is that Noah Pardon and Skinbone Johnson were in one room, one office, talking about the appeal. Pardon was reluctant. He understood that this would jeopardize his practice. If he took the appeal, he would make the judge that he has to come before all the time very angry. He knew that would make it very difficult for him to successfully pursue his cases in that court. He was very reluctant to do it, but sitting in the next room listening was Stiles Hutchins, his partner, a little more than 10 years older than him, had a history of pursuing civil rights cases. He had sued the city of Chattanooga for not allowing black children to attend city summer activities. He had served in the Tennessee state legislature for 2 years during Reconstruction and had been successful in getting the Chattanooga poll tax reversed. He felt like it was civil rights now for his people. And so he went to Noah Pardon and said, we've got to take this case. We've got to take this case. To whom much is given, much is expected. And Noah Pardon agreed to take the case.
Noah Pardon, during the trial, did provide assistance to those three white lawyers. He was asked to help defend Ed Johnson. He declined to do that for all the reasons that you just said, Catherine, but he had traded notes with one of the white lawyers at the trial. He had helped the defense locate witnesses for Johnson's alibi. So he was involved in the case in that trial, but now he had a decision to make about whether to go public along with Stiles Hutchins to make that appeal.
Yes. And one of the things that is really powerful when you do study what happened, I got to see a lot of this when I was in the public defender's office, that yes, the choice you make when your livelihood is lost sometimes depends upon the judge's attitude or concern for you. And one of the things about appellate practice is that it was meant to be an oversight. When the public defender system was created here in Hamilton County in 1990, there was a lot of power in the fact that my clients were the people that I represented. And no matter who was on the bench, the bottom line was the choices that I made were the choices that I made for the client and also to the people who elected me, because Tennessee was one of the few places that had elected public defenders. So therefore, it was really, really powerful, because not only was he dealing with reputation, but I'm sure he was also dealing with finances, because just getting to where you had to go. I mean, we're looking at the benefits of electronics and computers and all of these things now. Can you imagine? His brief had to be handwritten by somebody who wrote well. And so, you know, just that power in the preparation was just not, you handed it off to somebody and they took care of it. I'm sure he did a lot of that himself.
On Tuesday, February 13th, Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins filed a motion seeking a new trial. The judge, Samuel McReynolds, rejected the appeal, noting that the motion had not been filed within 72 hours as required. However, Judge McReynolds counted Sunday as part of that required time frame.
Right. I think we have to back up a little bit and go to February 12th, the day before. So on Monday, the day before, Stiles Hutchins and Noah Pardon go to the courthouse and they speak informally with Judge McReynolds, the trial judge, and tell him first they have to file a motion for a new trial, which is a condition precedent before you can file the appeal. Judge McReynolds is offended. He did everything right in this trial, and how dare you question his trial. But he says to them, wait until the next day to file your petition, because when you file your petition, I want the district attorney, Whitaker, to be here and file it then. Pardon says to the judge, well, don't we need to file this within 3 days? And Hutchins speaks up and says, well, you don't count Sunday. Judge McReynolds does not say anything. He sits there simply. Doesn't say, no, that's not right. He doesn't say, yes, you're right. But he's told them to come back the next day. And when they do come back the next day, he says, you're late. You've waived the right to appeal. I won't consider your motion for a new trial.
And that's the point where they turn to the Tennessee Supreme Court, which also denies the appeal and the request for a stay of execution.
Right. The Tennessee Supreme Court, no pardon, got on a train. You went to Nashville. So much for this. You can't do this electronic filing anymore. You have to go to the place where the clerk's office is located. Back in those
probably
days.
Probably with more than one copy.
Right.
Didn't have a fax machine.
He went on February 20th. He filed it. On March 3rd, the Tennessee Supreme Court issued their decision, in which they said that they had examined very carefully the technicalities of this case, which I take it to assume that they had examined whether or not Pardon had filed the motion for a new trial timely, and if he hadn't, were there some reasons to excuse that? And they said they found none. And it would be fruitless to issue a writ of error anyway, because they weren't going to issue a supersedious bond, that is, staying the execution. So basically, they're saying, well, we're not going to look at the substance of this anyway, because he's going to be executed on March 13th. They did not ever have a hearing. Pardon did not have an opportunity to argue the case. Let me go back just a little bit, if I may, just to understand hostility that the judicial officer of the Hamilton County Circuit Court had toward this filing and this appeal. You need to understand that in order to file an appeal, you have to get a transcript. To get a transcript, you have to ask the clerk of the court to provide one. Now, in certain cases where the defendant is indigent, then, as is now, you can get the state of Tennessee. The judge can certify for the state of Tennessee to pay for that. But he wouldn't do that. Then, when Noah Pardon went to the clerk of court to ask for the transcript, he was informed that the stenographer would not provide a copy of the transcript until the entire amount was paid, which was unusual. The custom was that you could pay for part of it, get your transcript, and then pay for the rest of it later. So Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins had to go around to the Black community to raise the money to pay for the transcript. He also needed access to the file to prepare his petition to the Tennessee Supreme Court, and was told by the clerk of the court that Judge McReynolds had the file in his office and he couldn't have it. So he had to overcome a tremendous number of barriers. He did eventually get the transcript, and I'm assuming the file. When he did get the transcript, though, it needed to be certified by the district judge as authentic. And about an hour before he got the transcript, according to In Contempt of Court, Judge McReynolds took an unscheduled weeks-long vacation in Florida. Every step that they are taking is made difficult. I think that just made them more determined to persevere.
Because we're not only talking about this appeal process in the legal sense, this is also a psychological battle of wills.
Yes, I'm sure that it is one of those things where I've been in courtroom situations before where even in the time that I've been practicing, the great sense that I always had was at the end of the day, no matter what the judge said or how they did it, I always had the opportunity to go to another court. I think in the back of my mind, I could always have this thought, you're not the boss of me, so just say what you have to say. I'm not going to take it personally, but we'll go on. But one of the things that you begin to understand from the judiciary sometimes, and people have to understand, a lot of times, some of these judges, they may not have been lawyers. I mean, it used to be you didn't have to be a judge in order to be on the bench. I'm not sure exactly what the situation was during Ed Johnson, but I do know that a lot of judges think that they have power. And, you know, everybody wants to be friends with the judge because no matter what happens, you can get certain things done. So therefore, to take a constitutional right that you have a right to challenge, and then all of a sudden, how dare these people keep coming back, even though you put these barriers up in their way? It had to be just a situation that there had to be this moral sense of outrage to keep them moving, or else it would have been easy to say, look, I got to go to work next week. You know, I got a trial coming up where the buggy ran over my neighbor. So I want to at least get a favorable ruling or help with this judge. So therefore, just understanding the will, because some people can be very bright and do certain things legally and jump through certain hoops. But to know that you want to fight and that you're going to keep this battle going, and not so much make it so personal as it is just because it was the right thing to do.
And they keep going. The next stop, as they keep going, U.S. District Court in Knoxville.
Kind of an interesting story that Sheriff Shipp and No Pardon board the same train to go to Knoxville. Sheriff Shipp is going there to recover Ed Johnson, to bring him back to Chattanooga so that he can be executed on March 13th. However, he's sitting in the front, first class of the train, and Noah Pardon is way in the back of the train, sitting in the colored section. That's the only place where he's allowed.
Joseph F. Shipp is the Hamilton County Sheriff in 1906. He and Noah Pardon sit in two different sections of the train a decade after a ruling by the United States Supreme Court. In 1896, the court, in Plessy v. Ferguson, upheld racial segregation in public facilities as constitutional, as long as the separate facilities for whites and blacks were of the same quality, or, as the court put it, separate but equal. We'll come back to this in more ways than one later in our conversation, as we return now to Sheriff Shipp and Noah Pardon taking a segregated train to Knoxville.
They arrive in Knoxville. Sheriff Shipp visits friends, has some social time, and goes to lunch. In the meantime, Noah Pardon goes over to the Federal District Court, United States District Court for the Eastern District of Tennessee, located then in Knoxville, and files a 9-page petition for habeas corpus under the Habeas Corpus Act of 1867, asking that the execution be stayed and that the court hear the grievances that they brought, namely that Ed Johnson was not afforded a fair trial.
The Habeas Corpus Act of 1867, to which you refer, giving an individual the right to ask a federal court to review their case if they felt that their constitutional rights have been violated by a state court, this was put in place during Reconstruction to ensure that African Americans and those who had supported the Union would be able to receive due process in the former Confederate states.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
and to make sure that they had that opportunity, because I think there was this vision, no matter what courts were doing, there was that possibility, depending upon what side of the war you may have been in, that you may not have been treated fairly. So that was really powerful, but seldom used.
Yeah, it was seldom used. And I actually did some research on this, and it's been a couple of years, but I tried to find some cases prior to Ed Johnson's case in which the Supreme Court considered whether the Bill of Rights applied to a state court case, whether they would intervene in a state criminal case. And I couldn't find a single one. I did find a number of cases that addressed whether the state court had jurisdiction over the criminal defendant or whether it should have been tried in federal court. I think there was one case in 1896, I think, in which the Supreme Court did apply the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause and said that a state court could not systematically and intentionally leave Black men out of the jury pool, and that that was a violation of a defendant's 14th Amendment right. So when Hardin filed his petition, that was one of the grounds for his petition before the district court, but it wasn't the only ground.
And the power also is in the fact that Hardin had to have, you know, how we all now have listservs where we can have a question and we put it up the flagpole and somebody writes us back and say, hey, why don't you try this? And I'm sure he had to have some relationship with someone else that said, hey, this is out there. You may want to use it. As I stated earlier, the thing that got me was when the constitutional law class I taught, the chapter about the 14th Amendment and habeas corpus, there was nothing there. It said the Supreme Court's position at the time was it's all a state's rights issue, and there was very little interference to have the federal court come in and oversee what was going on in the state court.
And it's very easy for those of us who may have a cursory sense of history at that time. We might know about Plessy versus Ferguson because that was reversed by Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. Plessy versus Ferguson was 1896, a decade before the Ed Johnson case. Those of us who may have a cursory sense of that history, the precedent was built over time, case after case after case after case after case. And when we're talking about Ed Johnson, there were so many grounds to challenge this. Catherine, you mentioned one of them. We should talk about some of the other ones here. There was no pretrial motion for Ed Johnson's trial. There was a refusal to consider a change of venue, issue about self-incrimination, the parents barred from the courtroom, one of the jurors threatening violence toward Ed Johnson in open court and not admonished for that, a very long list.
There was. He argued that Ed Johnson's white attorneys had abandoned him. That was one of his strongest arguments, in that they had not even considered an appeal because, as Judge Clark said, they were so terrorized by the fear of a lynch mob. They argued that he had not received a fair trial for the many reasons that you just mentioned under the Sixth Amendment. And that led to an interesting problem, which Judge Clark had to address. Could he, as a federal judge, apply the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial to a state court case? And that was one of the issues that was to be addressed. You know, we talk about this tension between state authority and federal authority. You just see time and time and time again this tremendous pull back and forth. When Noah Hardin gets his order from Judge Clark, who was the U.S. District Judge, that he is going to hear the petition the following Saturday at noon, a copy of that is taken over to the Knox County Jail. Sheriff Shipp, after his very pleasant lunch, leaves to go to the Knox County Jail to pick up Ed Johnson and bring him back to be hung in Chattanooga on March 13th. And he is met by a United States Marshal and the sheriff of Knox County, who hands him a copy of the petition and Judge Clark's order. He reads it. He says, "What does this mean?" And the marshal says, "This means you can't take Ed Johnson." He then turns to the sheriff and says, "Can a federal judge do this in a state court case?" And neither of them say a word, but he is forced to turn around and go back to Chattanooga without his state prisoner. Today, that would never happen. It would never happen. It is amazing to me these little things. But nevertheless, we still continue even today to see the power struggle between the state and federal government in many, many things.
And the other extreme is that at some time you have the issue where the federal government's power may make a difference, but there's nobody knocking at the door. That's the part sometimes that's even more terrified than the actual friction, than when someone just sits back and goes, oh, well, I'm sorry, not here today. You know, the person that went on vacation, you know, if I can't intimidate you personally, well, then I'll just kind of do things my way, knowing that there's going to be an impact. People's lives are going to be affected. Sometimes the tension is bad, but sometimes it can just be just as bad just to say no. And part of you kind of want to understand, they may have had an issue with the sheriff. You know, you don't know if it was the issue with the sheriff or were they just really there to protect Ed Johnson. They just could have been just not crazy about the sheriff. Or the other extreme sometimes is you have some judges there say, all I have to do is listen. I may have my mind made up, but you can at least say you had an opportunity to be heard. That was part of the issue, too, with the first stop was no opportunity to be heard. Oh, okay. Now I understand what my Fifth Amendment rights are. My due process. Yay. I got that right. Our opportunity to be heard.
No pardon had raised a 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause claim. That is that no black men were in the jury pool. You already had a Supreme Court case that said that systematically excluding black men from the jury pool violates the 14th Amendment. So he had a basis to bring that petition before Judge Clark. So I think Judge Clark probably had to hear it, and he did. But then there were, within that same petition, many issues raised that had never been addressed before. And the primary one being, could the court applied the Sixth Amendment right of a fair trial to a state court conviction or state court case. That had never been addressed before. At least it had not been done before by the Supreme Court.
And when Judge Clark heard these arguments, he heard from Ed Johnson's attorneys. Those attorneys went back and forth with Judge McReynolds and the district attorney, Matt Whitaker. And they both resented having their conduct scrutinized, let alone questioned.
They were furious. Judge McReynolds was furious. The courtroom was divided into two sections, and one section was filled with black citizens and are sprinkled with a few white citizens. The other side was all white. And at counsel's table, you had Lewis Shepard, Noah Pardon, and Stiles Hutchins. At the other table, you had Matt Whitaker, the district attorney and an assistant DA. And sitting with them, which I find highly inappropriate, was Judge McReynolds, sitting with the prosecution. Behind them, Sheriff Shipp and two deputies. And Noah Pardon didn't hold anything back. He let him have it. Here is this black man in a society that is basically a two-class society. If you're white, you're at one level. If you're black, you're at another level. And he is calling Judge McReynolds out, detailing all the things that went wrong with the trial. And Judge McReynolds was incensed. One thing that Noah Pardon pointed out was he had found out that prior to the trial, the mayor of Chattanooga, Sheriff Shipp, Judge McReynolds, the prosecutor, and two of the white attorneys appointed by Judge McReynolds to represent Ed Johnson had had a secret meeting that is not in court to discuss whether the case should be postponed or a change of venue should be granted because of the heightened feelings of the community. The thought was if you did postpone the trial, there would be a lynching. And for that reason, they determined not to file a motion for change of venue or postponement of the trial. That was testimony. That was testimony in the habeas corpus petition from one of Ed Johnson's appointed attorneys, WGM Thomas. That's what he testified to. McReynolds was furious. How do you know this happened? He speculated that Noah Pardon had gotten this information from Lewis Shepard, who was one of the original attorneys in the trial. Shepard and McReynolds had been friends. Shepard was a former judge. They had been friends. They had eaten together. They had socialized together. But this was the end of that friendship.
The thing that always gets me now is that how so many people, when you're dealing with the court and you're expecting to go in and go before a judge who's going to be independent and not biased. And I love old movies. And I want to throw in one of the, I think it's Tass Kimberlake was this one old movie that I love. And it's amazing, this group of people, they go to the country club and they go to plays and they're doing all these things. And they're having these dinners with him at the same time they have cases in front of him. And everybody seems to think it's okay. And I'm watching it, you know, in my real life time, and I'm going, oh my goodness, this is the way things actually happen. But, you know, a lot of people don't understand some of this stuff is kind of baked into the system for a long, long time. And the weird part is at the end, the judge is the one that kind of says, well, no, I'm going to be strong and brave. No, you're not supposed to be with these people. Once they come in front of you, Catherine, you can help me or not, but you either recuse yourself or you make other things happen. But a lot of this stuff is only kind of happening now because there are teeth in federal rules and there are people that are protected if you want to bring up issues with regards to the judges. But to have a judge sit at a table when you're going on appeal, you got to be ready for serious battle by then. And, you know, you really don't have anything to lose.
By today's standards, I think Judge McReynolds would have been brought up on ethics charges.
Oh, yes. Oh.
Having that separate meeting with the mayor. What does the mayor have to do with this case?
Did you end up with an explanation like, I think it was at the Rodney King case out of California when the police officer said, why were you kicking him so hard? You know, I was trying to keep him down to save him from other pains. And the thing that kind of gets me is when you keep seeing this, the other option is lynching. The other option is lynching. You want to know, had they really seen one? Had they participated? They had to know that that was a level at which a lot of people, it's something that some people say, once you've experienced it, you don't forget it. And you either love to do it again, or that's just not a path you'll ever cross.
They had contacted Governor Cox, and Governor Cox declined to send troops. So basically, they were saying, you're on your own over there, Hamilton County. And decisions were made about how the procedures of this case should go forward on the basis of whether or not the defendant was going to be lynched by a mob of citizens taking the law into their own hands. That is just unfathomable. But it was the reality, apparently, in 1906.
And speaking of Tennessee Governor John Cox, by the time that this case arrived at U.S. District Court in Knoxville in front of Judge C.D. Clark, there were questions about whether Clark had the authority to delay an execution ordered by the state, and Governor Cox agreed to issue a stay on March 12th, but there was a catch. It was only for 7 days, and Ed Johnson's lawyers had 1 week to file their appeal with the United States Supreme Court, and neither Noah Pardon nor Stiles Hutchins had standing to present a case before the U.S. Supreme Court.
No, they didn't. They didn't have standing. Let's back up a little bit. After a 10-hour hearing in which the primary argument of the state is you don't have jurisdiction, judge, as a federal judge, to intervene in a state criminal court case, Judge Clark retires to do his deliberations and reach a determination and comes back at 12:37 a.m. in the wee hours of the morning and basically says there were two problems with this case. Number one, there was the rush to trial. You just didn't give the attorney sufficient time to prepare, to seek other possibilities for what happened to Nevada Taylor. And then the second was that the whole process was permeated by this terror, literal, he used the word terror, that the defendant's attorneys were terrorized by fear of mob violence. And he said, even if he had not received a fair trial, even if the Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial had been violated, he didn't think that the federal court had jurisdiction to intervene in the state court case. However, he was going to give a 10-day stay of execution to allow the parties to file a petition and appeal with the U.S. Supreme Court. And you're right, they had, I think, did you say 7 days? 7 days to file that petition. They ended up going to an attorney, a black attorney in D.C., Emmanuel Hewlett, who had acted as co-counsel a number of times. in the Supreme Court, Attorney Hewlett introduced no pardon to the Supreme Court and gained admission for him. And that's how he had to do it. But here he's trying to get his legal arguments together, get his authority together. And he's got to run around and find somebody to admit him to the court. He's got to have 25 copies. It has to be on a certain color paper. The paper has to be a certain size.
It wasn't cut and paste. You didn't cut and paste what he filed earlier. This is a whole different process.
Yeah. All the while he's dealing with threats of violence. His law practice was attacked. His family home was attacked.
That was part of some of the things that happened, I think, during that period of time was, you know, if you couldn't get the person, you definitely went after the family and the property. And to think he didn't have a phone that he could just pick up. He didn't have that ability to probably, you kind of wonder what was going on in the background because he's going ahead and fighting this fight. But if these people are going to terrorize Ed Johnson or there's this fear about the court, I'm sure they knew where he lived. They probably knew where he lived and where his practice was. And those are the things that as vicious and as, what can I say, terrorism was not new to the South. So therefore, this was not removed from any of the terrorist propositions that could have affected the people around and the people involved.
Right. It was domestic terrorism.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at my notes here. On Thursday, March 15th at 1:30 a.m. in the morning, Noah Pardon is still in his office. He's still trying to prepare this petition, which he and Mr. Hutchins worked on day and night. And at 1:30 a.m., he smells smoke. He goes outside to see that the adjoining building has been set afire and concludes that the people who did that were actually targeting him, but just set the wrong building on fire. And then at 3 a.m., his wife arrives with two neighbors, both carrying shotguns. She's terrified because somebody has thrown bricks into their house and, you know, broken the windows. So now he's trying to figure out, what am I going to do to protect my wife? I need to go up to Washington, D.C. It's going to be a four-day trip. How am I going to protect her? And later that morning, according to intent of court, T.H. McCauley comes to the office and says, your wife can come and stay with us, with my wife, Ellen, and I on our farm on Missionary Ridge while you go to D.C. So he was able to go to D.C. knowing that his wife was safe.
Contempt of Court is the book about the Ed Johnson case, written by Mark Curridan and Leroy Phillips, published in 1999. You've heard it mentioned before in our conversations, and you'll hear about it again in our upcoming conversations.
And then when March 16th rolls around, 4 days left on the clock, Pardon and Hewlett file a brief with the clerk of the United States Supreme Court. They're asked to return the following day in case Associate Justice John Marshall Harlan had any questions for them. He was the justice at that time who was responsible for hearing emergency appeals from the Sixth Circuit.
And also the dissenting judge in Plessy versus Ferguson, which is powerful.
The only dissenting justice mm-hmm. in that decision of, quote, separate but equal.
But equal, yes.
And of all the justices on the court that Ed Johnson's legal team would have wanted to hear this appeal, he was the one that they received. Not only was he that dissenting opinion in Plessy versus Ferguson, he was the son of a Kentucky slave owner.
He knew, as a Southerner, what the reality of the situation was. He knew what separate but equal really meant. It didn't mean equal at all. It meant we're creating two classes of people here. And he had been waiting 30 years for the right kind of case to come to the Supreme Court. And Ardina, I think you've heard, I'm sure you've heard the expression, you know, good facts make good law, bad facts make bad law. And in this case, Ed Johnson's trial was so egregious. It was such a sham that it was good facts, so to speak, to take to the Supreme Court and say, federal courts must intervene in cases like this where a person's individual rights are so trampled.
And you've got a person being executed where the victim did not die. that was the other part that was just so egregious. You know, even the people that wanted to say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, well, a life for a life. This wasn't a murder. This wasn't somebody who was accused of intentional killing of somebody. This was a rape case where the victim, most cases, especially now, there are very few cases that you're going to, especially after the Georgia Supreme Court ruling, I wish I could remember the name. But up until that point, rape was one of those things that you could get death for. It was a death penalty sentence that could happen. But a lot of the pleadings during that time and the rulings during those cases said, we want to have the really serious punishments for the really serious crimes. And if someone is still alive, as much as we don't want to diminish sexual assaults on females, we do want to make sure that people who are going to lose their life are going to lose their life because they took a life. And I think even the studies have shown out of all of the people that may have been executed for rapes, there were no white males have ever been executed for rape.
So you had asked, though, about no pardon going to the Supreme Court and having an audience with Justice Harlan. And that was on Saturday, March 17th. Keep in mind that under Governor Cox's order, the execution could take place on March 20th. Under the federal judge Clark's order, the execution could not take place until March 23rd. Nobody knew at that point really which stay applied. But no pardon goes to the office. He sits in that office. He sits in that office for hours and hours. He's afraid to take lunch. He's afraid to go to the bathroom because he's afraid if he gets up and they call him in, he won't be there. He'll lose his opportunity to make his argument to Justice Harlan. So eventually, near the end of the day, he gets called into the chambers and he's able to present his case. And Justice Harlan asks a number of questions, but doesn't tell him anything about what his ruling might be. So he has to leave and go back to Chattanooga, heading back to Chattanooga on that 15-hour train ride, not knowing whether he has prevailed or not.
That's also powerful sometimes because you can have all of this. Oh, I could have said this or I should have said that. To know that you've got to go back, that's got to be an interesting train ride back.
Because that was the quickest way for him to get back at that point
right.
in time. It was not a matter of getting on a plane.
And also you had separate stagecoaches. So therefore, if you had to go, you had to go off the train, probably, especially for the Black passengers.
And then on Sunday, March 18th, Justice Harlan of the United States Supreme Court arranged for two telegrams to be sent, one delivered to the U.S. District Court in Knoxville and the other to Sheriff Shipp in Chattanooga. Justice Harlan decided to stay the execution of Ed Johnson, allowing his lawyers to file a petition with the entire United States Supreme Court. The telegrams were printed in the newspaper for the people of Chattanooga to read. This was something that had never been done before, but it was a long shot of long shots.
The Supreme Court had never intervened in a state criminal case to determine whether the Bill of Rights applied to protect the defendant. And the citizenry of Chattanooga was outraged, just outraged, as was Judge McReynolds, who publicly criticized the decision. This meant now that there was going to be a long wait for the briefing schedule. And you had to wait until the Supreme Court started its term. And this could be months. And the mob had demanded swift and immediate justice. So a fervor. The newspaper, they engaged in quite a bit of yellow journalism and really whipped the people up. And it was openly stated, you know, how dare the federal court intervene in state business?
First, they're probably thinking, how dare they even bring in the federal government to our business, because we've at least tried to make sure everything stays the way it should stay. And a lot of people may not understand truly. The problem was part of the case was that there were just things that were overlooked. There were just things that may have been the way that you should have done it, but it just shouldn't have been done that way. And he didn't set aside the conviction. He didn't say, hey, we're going to start over from scratch. He just said, we need an opportunity to actually hear more about what's going on.
You know, what's really interesting about that, according to, again, in contempt of court, is that Judge Clark, after issuing his ruling, in which he stayed execution for 10 days to give time to prepare the petition for the Supreme Court. He was so uncertain himself of his authority and power to do that, that he telephoned Judge McReynolds, and together they called Governor Cox and requested another stay. It was sort of a backup for Judge Clark's stay. And I'm kind of reading between the lines here. You've got McReynolds and Clark on the phone. They call the governor of Tennessee, Governor Cox, and explain the situation to him, that there's some question about whether Judge Clark's order actually can apply, and he has the authority to stay that execution. And Governor Cox, instead of a 10-day stay, gives a 7-day stay. And I sort of interpret that as Governor Cox kind of, you know, moving his power around, showing his power and the state's power. All right, we'll give you a stay because you've asked us to, and we want to get along with the federal government. But just to show you who's boss, you're not going to get a 10-day stay. We're going to give you a 7-day stay. Mm-hmm.
Which I think sometimes a lot of people have difficulty in understanding, as powerful as the decision was that came from Justice Hardin. Like I said, why can't we just say, this is so terrible, let's just throw it all out? No, that didn't happen. It was kind of like, we want to back it up so that when we say it's fair, it's fair. When we say that we've done what we've done, you know, we've done it well. But yes, let's get real and understand that some things that are up for review need to be reviewed so it doesn't happen again. But we're dealing with now people who thought, how dare you question what I do? Let me show you how really bad I can make it.
And let's remember that this case took place in 1906, 41 years after the end of the Civil War, just under 30 years after the end of Reconstruction. When we're talking about people in Chattanooga outraged, when we're talking about the mob outraged, we're talking about people who either lived through the Civil War and Reconstruction, or they are the children of those people.
And had relatives who had either owned slaves or were slaves.
That's a very good point. It's all still very fresh. And I go back to the social hierarchy. If you did something as a Black man, if you were accused as a Black man of having done something to a white woman, you were so far out of that social hierarchy that there had to be swift punishment, and your due process rights didn't matter. Of course, there was ample evidence that Ed Johnson was not anywhere near the place where Nevada Taylor was raped on the night of the rape, and the evidence connecting him to Nevada Taylor was just so slim, which is another reason why I say good facts make good law, bad facts make bad law. There just was so little evidence to support the conviction, notwithstanding all the procedural problems.
But even her identification of him, it could be the man, I'm not sure.
Right. It made it a good case to take it to the Supreme Court.
By this point, the facts did not matter to the mob in Chattanooga, to the people in Chattanooga beyond the mob who were just as outraged. And neither did the order from Associate Justice John Marshall Harlan.
I think this story and this history and what was going on, are we living some of the same things over again? We have some people that can look at this case and say, like Schiff said, the government, they caused this man to be lynched. I think we really need to look at our history and remember we're talking about human beings. And we need to understand that some of this, and I've heard some people talk about people can pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and these types of things. But when you have a history where even your way of appealing and making sure that the court system is going to be fair to all had its own issues, because what the court did after Plessy versus Ferguson, I tell my friends sometimes when we're having discussions about anti-racist ideas, you have to understand the court and the government was involved in us being treated less than humans or being differently than the whites in our community. So therefore, we need to know what that history is and know what we're battling with, so that when history starts repeating itself like it has been, we can understand this isn't new. A lot of people want to say, this is not the America that I know. Well, this was a part of the America that we know, and we've got to accept that part so we don't go back there again.
How we do something is as important as what we do. Every person is entitled to due process. Every person is entitled to the opportunity to be heard, to present their arguments. We can't ever let decisions about what's right and wrong be based on fear of violence, no matter who that violence might come from. I think a lot of this mob violence was based on this outrage that the Black community was getting too big for their britches. That's not how things are run here. And I don't think Chattanooga was unique about that. And we're going to show you how things are done here if you try to rise above your station. And that motivated the mob violence.
And got the sheriff reelected.
Got the sheriff reelected.
All right. Catherine, Ardina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
In our next conversation, we return to Chattanooga and a visit for Ed Johnson at the Hamilton County Jail. Our thanks to Catherine McCauley Gardner, Ardina Garth Hicks, the members of the Ed Johnson Project, and to Tony R. Smith Sr., Willie Kitchens, and their fellow musicians for I Am an Innocent Man, the Ed Johnson song. Visit the Ed Johnson Project at its website, edjohnsonproject.com, and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC.